Well, we're just going to keep picking up in Genesis where we left off. And if you've been tracking with us, we finished last week with Genesis chapter 22, the sacrifice of Isaac. And if you remember from last week, you'll remember that 22 really is the apex of the Abraham story. Everything that we're going to cover, we're going to finish Abraham's life this evening. And everything kind of from chapter 22 on is almost transitionary. It's kind of like he reached the apex, the ultimate test of his faith in Genesis chapter 22 with the sacrifice of Isaac. And everything there is kind of, now we're shifting gears and we're looking to the future and kind of tying up some loose threads as the scene transitions to Isaac. And so I think that's one of the major lessons even from this section is even as important and foundational as Abraham was to God's plan, we see that, one, he didn't receive the promises. He never, you know, God says, I'll make your seed as multitude, you know, as many as the stars in the sky and the sand on the seashore. And, you know, he dies with one kid from that promise, basically. And so much the message of this is that the promise and God's plan extends beyond just one person, as important as that person is. That God's plan is going to continue on, extend on. And so God's plan doesn't die with Abraham, but we see it transferred on to Isaac. And that's kind of how we'll end, as Abraham dies. And, you know, it's kind of almost a shock in one sense. We've been walking with Abraham for so long, seeing how God's using him. But ultimately, he's just a man. And ultimately, God's plan is bigger than a man. God's plan is worldwide. And obviously, we are the beneficiaries of that global plan that extends throughout the ages. And so you see it's broader than just him. But at the same time, as I said, you know, you see his life of faith and just how it, as I said, apexes in chapter 22 when he in one sense proves himself once and for all with the sacrifice of Isaac. That's kind of the ultimate test. And from then on out, there's in one sense no more blessings, no more. We don't see any more of Abraham's failures of faith. We just see him preparing for the future. And so that's kind of where we'll look at this evening. So maybe when we get done, depending on how much time it takes, we could just spend some time reflecting on everything we've learned from the life of Abraham. But for now, let's dive into chapter 23. So chapter 23 of Genesis. Sarah lived 127 years. These were the years of the life of Sarah. And Sarah died at Kiriath Arba, that is Hebron, in the land of Canaan. And Abraham went in to mourn for Sarah and to weep for her. And Abraham rose up from before his dead and said to the Hittites, I am a sojourner and a foreigner among you. Give me property among you for a burying place, that I may bury my dead out of my sight. The Hittites answered Abraham, Hear us, my lord. You are a prince of God among us. Bury your dead in the choicest of our tombs. None of us will withhold from you his tomb to hinder you from burying your dead. Abraham rose and bowed to the Hittites, the people of the land. And he said to them, If you are willing that I should bury my dead out of my sight, hear me and entreat for me Ephron the son of Zohar, that he may give me the cave of Machpelah, which he owns. It is at the end of his field. For the full price let him give it to me in your presence as property for a burying place. Now Ephron was sitting among the Hittites, and Ephron the Hittite answered Abraham in the hearing of the Hittites, of all who went in at the gate of his city, No, my lord, hear me. I give you the field, and I give you the cave that is in it. In the sight of the sons of my people I give it to you. Bury your dead. Then Abraham bowed down before the people of the land, and he said to Ephron in the hearing of the people of the land, But if you will, hear me. I give the price of the field. Accept it from me, that I may bury my dead there. Ephron answered Abraham, My lord, listen to me. A piece of land worth 400 shekels of silver? What is that between you and me? Bury your dead. Abraham listened to Ephron, and Abraham weighed out for Ephron the silver that he had named in the hearing of the Hittites, 400 shekels of silver, according to the weights current among the merchants. So the field of Ephron in Machpelah, which is in the east of Mamre, the field with the cave that is in it, and all the trees that were in the field throughout its whole area was made over to Abraham as a possession in the presence of the Hittites before all who went in at the gate of his city. After this, Abraham buried Sarah his wife in the cave of the field of Machpelah east of Mamre, that is Hebron, in the land of Canaan. The field and the cave that is in it were made over to Abraham as a property for a burying place by the Hittites. There you have it. The death of Sarah, the burial of Sarah. And as we do with every story that we come to Genesis, we have to ask ourselves, why is this story in here? You know, certainly it's a, in one sense, a lengthy story for what could be said in about two sentences, pretty simply. And so, just to start off with throwing out the question, what are some things that you either observe from this chapter, or what seems to be the emphasis, what seems to be repeated? What do we learn either about Abraham, probably, you know, obviously he being the main character, probably something about him that we're going to learn here. Any thoughts or observations? Any little observation may kind of be the key that leads us to where the author is going here. So let's just open it up for some time of observations. What do we see?
Something that probably is not what you were trying to get at, but something that they do repeat is the price of the field. And
good. Good. That is one of the points of this. And anyone want to hazard a guess? There's some other emphases that go along with that, but the price of the field is one. What else maybe? Let's see if I could find find the other verse. Oh, verse 16. What else is kind of a weird statement there? Notice that little ending statement of the verse, according to weights current among the merchants. It's like, that seems, you know, anytime you find a piece of information that seems just ancillary, it's like, why did the author even put that in there? Like, 400 shekels, who cares, like, you know, what weight or, you know, what standard he's using. But there seems to be an emphasis here, and I think this is kind of comes off your observation, William, that Abraham did this legally. You'll notice the emphasis that it's in the presence of all who are in the gate of the city. The city gate was where all the public transactions took place. And so it's very official. If you notice kind of the emphases in this chapter, it gives you the price, it gives you the fact that there were witnesses, it gives you the fact that he even used the standard, I guess you will, weight of the money. Just a lot of different emphases that come from this chapter that emphasize that he did this legally. And even just it didn't come out real clearly in my translation, but I think NASB makes it a little bit clear where it says, "were made over." I have it in verse 20. It's also in another place or two. But it's the idea of...
I'm sorry, it says deeded over.
Deeded over, good. That, once again, the word that's used there kind of points to the fact that it was very official, and there's like a transfer involved there. And I think that's one of the emphases, as you see throughout this chapter, is that this is a legal transaction that took place. And so then we have to ask ourselves, okay, why is the author making such an emphasis of this legal transaction? And I think it has a lot to do with the fact that it has a lot to do with Abraham's faith, which, of course, we've been seeing all throughout Genesis. But kind of put yourself back in Abraham's shoes. Here he's this, even in this chapter, right? He's a sojourner, a foreigner, verse 4, among them. He never owned a single piece of property in all the promised land. God had promised him this whole area of land, but he was just a sojourner. He just lived in tents. He never even owned a piece of land. But at the very end of his life, he finally legally acquires a piece of the promised land. And I think it really points to the fact that, well, even as we'll get to chapter 24, Abraham had really grabbed hold of this promise. He had recognized that this is ultimately his land, and it's kind of like putting a stake in the ground, if you will, where he's like, this is my homeland. I own a piece of this ground. And so he even buries his wife there. Even think about that from the ancient Near Eastern culture. You know, typically you'd go back to your ancestors' land and bury your wife, you know, and you could almost think of him, well, okay, it's been nice here in the promised land, and, you know, we've been sojourners, but now it's time to go back home at the end of his life. But no, he's like, I'm going to bury, in other words, we're going to die here. This is the promised land. We know that in the future, God is going to give us this land. He kind of puts his stake down. He buries his wife here. There's no going back to Ur. There's no going back to on God's promises, but he looks forward in faith and says, this land God is going to give me. And so I think that's a major emphasis. And like you said, just through those simple observations, I think that's really one of the major points of this chapter as Moses writes it.
Well, yeah, and when you think about it, he's not going backwards, he's going forward. He's a go-forward guy. I mean,
Yeah. It's
not, he wants it to be a legal transaction for the people that are there. And when his family actually is the caretakers of the land, they will know it's there because this is where Abraham was.
Yeah, and that's bringing out a good point as well, that remember that this is written to the Israelites as they're about to go in and conquer the promised land, and it's kind of like, well, we already had our stake here a long, long time ago, right? And it gives them that, in one sense, basis as they go in, just so much of Genesis is to give them that foundation to say, this is your land. You're coming in to take and to fulfill God's plan and his purpose for you, his people. And I think that this chapter really serves to emphasize that. There's also, I think, maybe another kind of goes along with that, maybe not a separate point, but what else do you notice about Abraham just throughout this story? How would you characterize how he interacted? I mean, obviously just the legality and such, but there's probably another word that I'd put on here. I mean, what do the Hittites tell him at first?
They just give it to him.
Yeah, it's like, we'll just give it to you. But what does Abraham do?
He wants to make sure he pays for it.
Right. And so I would probably just even going along with that, put on the word perseverance here.
Yeah.
You know, it's like they keep like, oh, we'll just give it to you. But Abraham was very insistent on, no, I want to own this land. I want to make sure. And if you notice, too, it's, you know, he wants to buy this land. Well, it's kind of almost a side note. It's not just this cave to bury his dead. It goes beyond. It's like this whole field. It's not like, okay, we'll just give you a place to put your dead wife. No, he actually purchased a field that has trees in it. It's a chunk of land. It's a chunk of home. And so you notice that emphasis as well, that Abraham is just persevering because he knows that this is ultimately going to be his land. And that's where his whole hope, his whole future lies. And so as we said in chapter 22, as we're transitioning from the life of Abraham, and the patriarchs are going to die, you know, and obviously here the matriarch of the family dies, you know, there's somewhat that question maybe lingering in the air, what would happen to the promise as these faithful people who God had chosen and used in such a powerful way start to die off? And you see that promise is going to continue. You see that Abraham has so grabbed firmly a hold of that promise that he's persevering and making sure that he, in one sense, just puts that stake in the ground. And I think, yeah.
Maybe also because these people are Hittites, he's concerned that they'll go back later, you know, after he's dead and say, no, that land's not yours anymore. So he wants to ensure that land is there, his property legally for the coming generations.
Yeah.
It also sounded like to me, my initial impression was Abraham's kind of one of these rugged pioneer types where, you know, he doesn't want to take charity from anybody. And
well, that's a good observation. That goes back to, if you remember all the way back till, it's not that far back, where is it with Melchizedek? I think it is in chapter, who can find it?
Chapter 14.
You remember what happened there? And one of the commentators brought out that same point, that Abraham would not take a single thing from the king of Sodom, because obviously the king of Sodom was wicked, but more than that, because he wanted to make it so abundantly clear that God had blessed him. He didn't, and you remember that section there, he's like, I will not even take a sandal strap from you, because I want it to be clear to everyone that God promised to bless me, and so I don't have to take things from other people. God will bless me. And I think that that may be part of the reason, too, why he wants to actually pay for the land. The Hittites didn't make Abraham rich, right? He was blessed by God. And that's even another interesting point as you come in here. As we talked about Abraham's role among the people of the land, remember how we talked about, I think it was last week, that Abraham really, if you want to be blessed, you got to get in touch with Abraham, right? God says, I will bless the world through you. And so we saw in, you know, with Lot, that Lot was saved because of Abraham. We saw with other peoples of the land, Abimelech, that's right, that Abimelech was basically blessed as because Abraham prayed for him. And here I think you see a similar thing in that, notice verse 6, that they recognize God's blessing on Abraham. They call him a prince of God. You know, and there's this recognition that Abraham is blessed of God and just as in his peaceful living among the people of the land. And it does tie back to so much of what Israel's purpose was in that they were to be this blessed people of God through which all the peoples of the earth saw God's blessing upon them and therefore kind of went to them for blessing and went to Israel for, you know, understanding about who God is. And you kind of see that same kind of recognition here, even with these pagan peoples around them, whether it be Abimelech, whether it be the Hittites. God's blessing was, because of his obedience, because of his faith, God's blessing was so clearly evident upon Abraham that everyone could notice it. And I think that ties in with a lot of the themes that we've been seeing in this book, is that if you obey God, you know, there's blessing for obedience. God wants to bless his people, to use them in a powerful way so that his name will go forth throughout the earth. And so that's certainly a part of, I would say, one of the lessons we learn from this chapter. Okay? It's you know, in one sense, it's fun for me because you turn to it's just a simple story and you're like, okay, what's the point of that? And just the more you study it, the more you see, oh yeah, the author did include this for a point. He could have just said, and Sarah died, and Abraham bought a cave and buried her in it. But he includes this whole story because he does want to get across just these lessons that he keeps trying to drill home throughout the book.
You see, this is him buying. I was going to say, like a homestead.
Well, I mean, in the sense, I mean, he knows he's going to die soon as well. So I don't know that he was. I think it's more an act of faith that, you know, even in the sense that, well, I'll pass it down to my ancestors, and this is our land, this is our home, this is, you know, I just kind of like the term. He's just putting a stake in the ground, you know, saying this is home. There's no going back. We depend upon God's promises. Some good lessons there for us. All right, any other questions before we move on to chapter 24 and just continue walking through the life of Abraham?
So what exactly is the deal with the price? Like, why do they care about the price so much?
Why did Abraham, or why did they, or...
Like, it feels like the precise value is kind of emphasis, too. Like, is it because it was a lot of money, or...
Yeah, I think it probably was. You know what, that one would be... I'd have to maybe do some more research to figure out, you know, 400 shekels, is that a lot, is that a little? But I would tend to think that that's a lot.
It says in the notes of my Bible that it was a lot, and that the seeming flippance of the offer of the Hittite was actually not so flippant, that it was more of a calculated gesture.
Right, so, and you could kind of see that in the sense that, you know, when he says, oh, you seems to be somewhat, you're getting into the ancient Near Eastern way of bartering at that point. It's like, oh, it's only 400 shekels of silver, you know, nothing between us. But then he kind of, in so doing, you know, kind of gets Abraham to pay that big of a price. So I would tend to see it like that, that, you know, that Abraham was willing to pay a lot in for this, to have this piece of ground. That's good. All right, next chapter is really great. It's a long one. Chapter 24, the story of Abraham securing a wife for Isaac. All right, let's dive in. Now, Abraham was old, well advanced in years, and Yahweh had blessed Abraham in all things. And Abraham said to his servant, the oldest of his household, who had charge of all that he had, "Put your hand under my thigh, that I may make you swear by Yahweh, the God of heaven and the God of earth, that you will not take a wife for my son from the daughters of the Canaanites, among whom I dwell, but will go to my country and to my kindred, and take a wife for my son Isaac." The servant said to him, "Perhaps the woman may not be willing to follow me to this land. Must I then take your son back to the land from which you came?" Abraham said to him, "See to it that you do not take my son back there. Yahweh, the God of heaven, who took me from my father's house and from the land of my kindred, and who spoke to me and swore to me, 'To your offspring I will give this land,' he will send his angel before you, and you shall take a wife for my son from there. But if the woman is not willing to follow you, then you will be free from this oath of mine. Only you must not take my son back there." So the servant put his hand under the thigh of Abraham his master and swore to him concerning this matter. We'll start off with the introductory paragraph there. Abraham really has two concerns here. What seem to be his two concerns?
Make sure his son will get married the woman that he wants him to marry.
Right. And more specifically, to a non-Canaanite woman. Now, as we've been tracing through Genesis, why would that be?
Canaanites were descendants of Ham, who had sinned and messed up and was cursed.
Right. So we saw, if you go all the way back, we see that Canaan was cursed. As Shem, Ham, and Japheth, Noah's three sons, remember the episode where Ham, you know, looked on his father's nakedness, and as a result, Canaan got cursed. And just obviously so important as the Israelites are about to go into the land of Canaan, that these wicked, ungodly, just horrific people that God's going to have them wipe out were under God's curse because of their wickedness and even because of the wickedness of their forefather. And so Abraham is very, very concerned that his son does not marry a Canaanite woman. And then he also has one other concern. What is that? Right. That Isaac doesn't return to the land of his forefathers. Once again, both of these things very much point out Abraham's faith, especially that latter one. You know, once again, it's because he had so firmly grasped onto the promise of God. You know, as you go to verse 7 even, he quotes what God said, "To your offspring I will give this land." You know, he doesn't have the land now, but he is so convinced that this land is his that he gets pretty adamant to his servant, right? He's like, "Swear, you have to swear to me that you will not do this." You know, he goes to great, great lengths to ensure that these things will not happen. And once again, it shows his faith, that he believes that this land, and notice even what he says, like, the servant kind of throws out a hypothetical, well, what happens if the woman doesn't want to come back? You know, what am I going to do? How does Abraham respond to that in a word? I love his response. What does he say?
God's going to take care of it.
Yeah, God will send his angel. I mean, we've seen the angel of Yahweh, you know, obviously appeared to him and prevented him from killing his son, you know, go throughout scripture. But I think the angel of Yahweh is this idea. It's God's messenger, and we even see at times how the angel of Yahweh is Yahweh himself. But it's the idea that God can, and obviously we know that God can kind of like snap his fingers and make things happen, if you will. But I love this idea that he could send a messenger, and it really speaks to the fact that God can send someone to take care of the situation. Does that make sense? Like the angel of Yahweh, it's not that God can't just miraculously make things happen, but it shows more, I guess, directly God's intervention. I guess I'll put it that way, right? He sends a messenger to intervene in the situation, and it shows that God is involved in the affairs of human life. And so Abraham is so convinced that, you know, God wants, A, his son not to marry a Canaanite, and B, he's so convinced that his son's not going to go back there that he's like, God will do a miracle if he has to make sure that this promise is kept. I love that kind of a thinking. He's like, well, you know, God can do what he needs to do to make this happen. You know, and that's a great application for us as well. You know, we come against things that seem like they could be roadblocks, you know, for us doing what's right. And God can do miracles to overcome those roadblocks. He calls us to obedience. He calls us to trust in him. And certainly we see that all throughout the Old Testament. But I love that just confident assurance that Abraham has that God's going to do whatever it takes to make sure his promise is fulfilled. And even if that means sending an angel, and I don't know what the angel, really convincing the girl, or I don't know what, you know, I guess if an angel showed up, it'd probably convince her, you know, but God's going to do what it takes. And so he makes them swear and sends the servant on his mission.
Yeah, I used to joke some buddies in college, you know, like, do you really, really promise to do this for me? Do we need to make this an Abrahamic oath?
Yeah. Yeah. That's good. So, introduction there. And as we'll see now, Abraham really kind of fades from the scene. Yeah, go ahead.
Sorry. I was actually just kind of wondering, it's probably a stupid question, but what was with, like, the servant putting his hand in his thigh? Like, what's...
I mean, it's just a custom that they had. I guess it's like, you know, spit and shake on it, or, you know, it's just they had different kind of customs for that kind of stuff. So this was just a very solemn way to, like...
It's kind of a compromising position. I don't want to use this word loosely, but I mean, it is an intimate moment in a sense of saying, like, you know, we're not going to break this bond that we have together right here. So, I mean, yeah.
Yeah. But obviously, it's just emphasizing how solemn this is. Just, it's an oath, cannot be broken, you know. And so the servant's like, all right, I'm off to it. And so Abraham, as I said, kind of fades from the scene at this point. And it's all, as we'll see in this chapter is just an amazing chapter of God's sovereignty. And I think we'll see this more in the book of Genesis as we get to the Joseph story. But God can make his promise come about, right? God can work in amazing ways. And we're going to see there's kind of like tension, you know, and how is this going to be resolved? But God is miraculous in the way he could do this. And so, it's just fun to read this story and watch how God works, because, you know, he is in control. He will make sure that he brings about his plan. Okay, so verse 10, the servant's going to set off. Then the servant took 10 of his master's camels and departed, taking all sorts of choice gifts from his master. And he arose and went to Mesopotamia, to the city of Nahor. And he made the camels kneel down outside the city by the well of water at the time of evening, the time when the women go out to draw water. And he said, Yahweh, God of my master Abraham, please grant me success today and show steadfast love to my master Abraham. Behold, I am standing by the spring of water, and the daughters of the men of the city are coming out to draw water. Let the young woman to whom I shall say, please let down your jar that I may drink, and who shall say, drink and I will water your camels, let her be the one whom you have appointed for your servant Isaac. By this I shall know that you have shown steadfast love to my master. And so the master sends off, and you love just the faith of this servant as well. I think one of the great lessons from this chapter is we've seen the faith of Abraham and how God uses that. But here we have just, in one sense, one of his lowly servants, and even how God uses the faith and the obedience of this servant in an amazing way to bring about his plan. And it's just the reminder that God can use whoever it is, whether it be Abraham, whether it be a servant, he uses obedience to bring about his plan and purpose. And obviously that's so much a lesson for us as well, that when we're faithful and obedient, God will use us as part of his plan. And so this servant, you know, he's dependent upon the Lord, and he's like, all right, I don't, you know, he doesn't know anyone, and he just sets off. And so he just prays to God. Just in faith and dependence upon God, and says, all right, you show me, Lord, who it's going to be that should be for my servant. And he says, show steadfast love. That's one of the key, you know, just key words in this section, just God's loyalty to Abraham. And that's what, in just humble dependence and faith, this servant prays for. He prays for God to show his loyalty, to show his steadfast love to Abraham. And just even his prayer is just a prayer of faith and trust. And so he kind of basically prays for a sign, right? You know, I'm going to go out here and I'm going to ask some young woman for a drink. And the woman, I say, give me a drink. And she's like, hey, let me give some water to your camels also. You know, that's the one. And so I love it. Verse 15, before he had finished speaking, you know, he's like in the middle of his prayer. And behold, you know, it's just like instant. And I think we all understand this, but it's worth noting. When it's so instant like that, it points out that it's not a coincidence. Right? This is no coincidence that God instantly answered his prayer. He didn't have to, like, wait around, try this girl. Nope, not her. Nope, not her. Nope, not her. You know, but he prays, and instantly, before he even finished, behold, Rivka, the Hebrew of the name Rebekah, who was born to Bethuel, the son of Milcah, the wife of Nahor, Abraham's brother, came out with her water jar on her shoulder. So it's interesting, you know, we saw earlier in, I think it was the end of chapter 22, we were introduced to Rebekah, you know, to set the stage for this chapter. So before he even finishes, she shows up. And so then we get introduced to her in verse 16. The young woman was very attractive in appearance, a maiden whom no man had known. She went down to the spring and filled her jar and came up. Then the servant ran to meet her and said, please give me a little water to drink from your jar. She said, drink, my lord. And she quickly let down her jar upon her hand and gave him a drink. And when she had finished giving him a drink, she said, I will draw water for your camels also until they have finished drinking. So she quickly emptied her jar into the trough and ran again to the well to draw water. And she drew for all his camels. The man gazed at her in silence to learn whether Yahweh had prospered his journey or not. So you see, just instantly God answers his prayer. And, you know, before he finished speaking, this woman shows up. It happens to be, you know, a relative of Abraham's, this attractive young maiden who had never known a man. And just as he prayed, it happened. He asked her, and she's, just kind of the little emphasis that's put in there as well. Notice, you know, she's running. She's like quickly. It just kind of shows her as industrious and I don't know what the right word would be. But I just love the fact that she's just running to serve him and just shows her eagerness to do so. And so as we continue on, when the camels had finished drinking, the man took a gold ring weighing a half a shekel and two bracelets for her arms weighing 10 gold shekels and said, please tell me whose daughter you are. Is there room in your father's house for us to spend the night? She said to him, I am the daughter of Bethuel, the son of Milcah, whom she bore to Nahor. She added, we have plenty of both straw and fodder and room to spend the night. The man bowed his head and worshipped Yahweh and said, so great, blessed be Yahweh, the God of my master Abraham, who has not forsaken his steadfast love and his faithfulness toward my master. As for me, Yahweh has led me in the way to the house of my master's kinsman. Then the young woman ran and told her mother's household about these things. You notice we start off with just the prayer of faith, the prayer of dependence of this servant. And then God immediately answers his prayer in such an amazing way and instantly just bows down and worships in response to the Lord and thankfulness to him. Just blessed be Yahweh who has done this. And obviously, just God's sovereignty in the whole situation. You see that he says, he has led me. You know, God guided his path. God sovereignly led him directly to this woman. Not only is, you know, did she answer his kind of test, if you will, but happened to be a relative even. You know, it's kind of almost unthinkable how, and just even the timing of it all, just God had sovereignly in such an amazing way answered this prayer and led this servant to this woman. And once again, that statement, God has not, Yahweh had not forsaken his steadfast love and his faithfulness. Just being such of the key words, God is faithful to his word. He's faithful to his promise. His loyal love to Abraham, that covenant relationship that they had entered into, God is faithful to it. And so, as we saw from the beginning, right, though Abraham will be blessed, and those who bless Abraham will be blessed, and God will be faithful to keep his word and his promise to his servant. And so, Abraham's servant just blesses God and praises God for his faithfulness. And so the story just continues on. Rebekah had a brother whose name was Laban. Laban ran out toward the man to the spring. As soon as he saw the ring and the bracelets on his sister's arms and heard the words of Rebekah his sister, "Thus the man spoke to me," he went to the man, and behold, he was standing by the camels at the spring. He said, "Come in, O blessed of Yahweh. Why do you stand outside? For I have prepared the house and a place for the camels." So the man came to the house and unharnessed the camels and gave straw and fodder to the camels. And there was water to wash his feet and the feet of the men who were with him. Then the food was set before him to eat, but he said, "I will not eat until I have said what I have to say." So he said, "Speak on." So he said, "I am Abraham's servant. Yahweh has greatly blessed my master, and he has become great. He has given him flocks and herds, silver and gold, male servants and female servants, camels and donkeys. And to Sarah, my master's wife, bore a son to my master when she was old, and to him he has given all that he has. My master made me swear, saying, 'You shall not take a wife for my son from the daughters of the Canaanites, in whose land I dwell, but you shall go to my father's house and to my clan and take a wife for my son.' I said to my master, 'Perhaps the woman will not follow me,' but he said, 'Yahweh, before whom I have walked, will send his angel with you and prosper your way. You shall take a wife for my son from my clan and from my father's house. Then you will be free from my oath when you come to my clan. If they will not give her to you, you will be free from my oath. I came today to the spring and said, 'O Yahweh, God of my master Abraham, if now you are prospering the way that I go, behold, I am standing by the spring of water. Let the virgin who comes out to draw water, to whom I shall say, "Please give me a little water from your jar to drink," and who will say to me, "Drink, and I also draw for your camels also," let her be the woman whom Yahweh has appointed for my master's son." Before I had finished speaking in my heart, behold, Rebekah came out with the water jar on her shoulder, and she went down to the spring and drew water. I said to her, "Please let me drink." She quickly let down her jar from her shoulder and said, "Drink, and I will give your camels drink also." So I drank, and she gave the camels drink also. Then I asked her, "Whose daughter are you?" She said, "The daughter of Bethuel, Nahor's son, whom Milcah bore to him." So I put the ring on her nose and the bracelets on her arms. Then I bowed my head and worshipped Yahweh and blessed Yahweh, the God of my master Abraham, who had led me by the right way to take the daughter of my master's kinsman for his son. Now then, if you're going to show steadfast love and faithfulness to my master, tell me, and if not, tell me that I may turn to the right hand or to the left." So there you just have like a whole retelling of the story, you know, just in the narrative, and it kind of, in one sense, kind of draws out the suspense, you know, as you're like, okay, what's going to happen as he retells the story, and also just reemphasizes like, wow, it's amazing how God led him all that way, you know, once again, and just kind of gives the author opportunity to retell again how blessed is Yahweh that he led him all that way. And I think that repetition just really kind of increases the suspense and the emphasis that God is the one who's indeed leading Abraham's servant. And so we're kind of at the fork in the road, and he says, you know, are you going to show steadfast love and faithfulness to my master or not? So, verse 50. Then Laban and Bethuel answered and said, This thing has come from Yahweh. We cannot speak to you, bad or good. Behold, Rebekah is before you. Take her and go, and let her be the wife of your master's son, as Yahweh has spoken. And so Laban, her father, and Bethuel, her grandfather, basically just confirm. They say, you know, what can we say to that? You know, how are you going to argue with that, right? I mean, Yahweh just appointed this path and directed him directly there. And so they say, okay, you know, this is obviously Yahweh has spoken. And so, verse 52, when Abraham's servant heard these words, he bowed himself to the earth before Yahweh. Once again, just his worship of Yahweh. And the servant brought out jewelry of silver and gold and garments and gave them to Rebekah. He also gave to her brothers and to her mother costly ornaments. And he and all the men who were with him ate and drank, and they spent the night there. When they arose in the morning, he said, "Send me away to my master." Her brother and her mother said, "Let the young woman remain for us for a while, at least 10 days. After that she may go." But he said to them, "Do not delay me, since Yahweh has prospered my way. Send me away that I may go to my master." They said, "Let us call the young woman and ask her." And they called Rebekah and said to her, "Will you go with the man?" And she said, "I will go." So they sent away Rebekah their sister and her nurse and Abraham's servant and his men. And they blessed Rebekah and said to her, "Our sister, may you become thousands of 10,000s, and may your offspring possess the gate of those who hate them." Then Rebekah and her young women arose and rode on the camels and followed the man. Thus the servant took Rebekah and went his way. And so we see the resolution of the matter, that they recognized that Yahweh was the one behind it. And then you even have kind of like another rise of tension where the mother is like, "Hey, let her stay 10 days, you know, and kind of the tension. But that's kind of cool because it gives Rebekah herself the opportunity to speak up and say, "No, I will go." And I think just emphasizes, you know, as we've kind of, I think, even seen just how she's quickly serving him, just somewhat even just of her character and the light in which the author's portraying her as just this, I guess you'd say, just faithful woman who wants to follow Yahweh's way. And so she, of course, is even willing to leave her family and leave everything and go with this servant just so quickly, right? Just on a moment's notice, it's like, this guy, I mean, can you imagine that? I mean, especially for you young ladies. This guy shows up at your door, knock, knock, "God sent me here. I'm here to take you thousands of miles away to marry this guy who you've never seen," right? And, you know, and so of course the mother's like, "Can you at least stay like 10 days? This is kind of sudden." But she's just like, "No, I'll go." You know, just instantly. And it's, I mean, I think it shows just, that's pretty amazing right there in and of itself. It's pretty cool just to see how even God had prepared her heart. And even as we've seen this whole way, certainly this is Yahweh's angel had come and just set everything just perfectly in line. Everything went just smoothly by the book. Just prayer answered, relative, just on and on it goes. And then finally the woman, Rebekah herself's like, "I'll go." And so you just see how God has worked this out so magnificently. And so you get to the kind of the what do you call it? The culmination, I guess, in verse 62, when they finally get to meet. Now Isaac had returned from Beer Lahai Roy and was dwelling in the Negev. And Isaac went out to meditate in the field toward evening. And he lifted up his eyes and saw, and behold, there were camels coming. And Rebekah lifted up her eyes, and when she saw Isaac, she dismounted from the camel. And she and said to the servant, "Who is that man walking in the field to meet us?" And the servant said, "It is my master." So she took her veil and covered herself, and the servant told Isaac all the things that he had done. Then Isaac brought her into the tent of Sarah his mother and took Rebekah, and she became his wife, and he loved her. So Isaac was comforted after his mother's death. And so, you know, kind of classic scene. She lifted up her eyes. He lifted up his eyes, you know. They finally meet just as the story comes to a beautiful conclusion. And
well,
so,
if you've been riding across the desert on a camel with these old men, anything would look good.
Yeah, it's good to point out that this is not a short journey. I mean, I'd have to go look, but it's thousands of miles, and on a camel, no less. And so it would have been quite
time to have doubts.
Yeah, but just it all went so smoothly. And you kind of have the transition You know, when it talks about him bringing him into his mother's tent, it's like all of a sudden now you see that one generation passing to the next as Sarah, as the matriarch, has died, and now Rebecca becomes the matriarch of the family. And so we're passing, as we said, we're transitioning into the next line of the story as the promise continues on.
Am I wrong in thinking that Isaac must be a good 40 years old?
I'd have to think about it, but I think that's right.
Because his mother died when she was 140-something.
Yeah.
Wasn't Abraham around 100 when he was born?
It says that he was 40 when he got married.
20 or chapter 25. You're my reader.
Isaac was 40 years old when he took Rebecca as wife. Yada, yada, yada.
You used to know how old she was.
She was 12.
Did you have a question in the back, Ken?
Yeah. I was thinking about this, like, as you read the line of Abraham, like, even though you read about, like, the serpent, it never mentions Cain. I was just thinking about that, like, even though he showed us, he demonstrated, like, a strong faith in the similarity of God, but he never had the name. The focus always in the back of the line of, the line of Abraham.
Right.
Like, can't even think back of anybody's name that they really mentioned other than the line of Abraham. I was just thinking in my mind that that's the focus. This doesn't really need to kind of talk about all these people, even though they showed faith, but they were naming the mention.
Yeah, and I think that kind of goes back, like, I think part of the point is just look how even God uses a servant, you know, and you think about in God's great plan. You don't want to get into the hypothetical what ifs or whatever, but, you know, in one sense, what if the servant hadn't acted faithfully or whatever, you know, like this is an integral part of God's plan. You know, there had to be a wife of Isaac for this line to continue. And so you just see how this servant who trusted in Yahweh and was faithful to him is so integral in God's plan coming about, you know. And so it is pretty neat to see that, even just this unnamed servant. I want to say that I think his name shows up somewhere, but I can't remember what it is. I think there might be some other reference somewhere that gives his name, but your point is no less valid, you know, that he's not the focal point. Yeah.
He serves such an important part, and he doesn't really get a name, at least for this part. Do you think that's maybe because he was a servant, and they don't get names, and they're at least in biblical texts, they're just sort of behind the scenes almost?
Well, but and in a sense, I think it even does go back to Ken's point. It's just keep the focus where the focus is, you know, and just on Abraham. And I think it does, it just shows, you know, how even insignificant people, in one sense, could be used by God in a powerful way. So it's a good lesson.
It's like casting a movie's servant. You're a film that's
it's like, oh, now I understand.
God's a good storyteller. Don't get it right. So.
No, you're right. I think you sense that, right? That these are just great stories.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and not to, like, limit them to that and miss the point, but they're artfully told. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's good.
Well, in the beginning was the Word. I mean, the Word, spoken or otherwise, is God. I mean, that's a part of his character. His being.
Right. He is a revealing God, and we are thankful for that he has revealed himself in his word.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's good.
Isaac was to be even older than Abraham. I was trying to see if I could figure out how old Rebecca was. I don't think it tells anywhere.
You're a tall lady.
Not even in the Bible.
Just don't ask people.
Well, when Isaac was old and fuzzy, she was still going to show. Right?
Just
running the show?
She was kind of running the show by that time, that's true.
All right, well, let's. let's kind of finish off the last part of chapter, or the first part of chapter 25 ends. Remember how we said the whole book of Genesis is divided up into these toledot statements? So the first 11 verses finishes off this first toledot and just kind of brings a conclusion to the whole story. And then the next few verses, well, we'll get to that in just a second, but just quickly to kind of bring conclusion to the whole life of Abraham, and let's just finish this off with chapter 25. Abraham took another wife whose name was Keturah. She bore him Zimran, Jokshan, Medan, Midian, Ishbak, and Shuah. Jokshan fathered Sheba and Dedan. The sons of Dedan were Asherim, Ledushim, and Leumim. The sons of Midian were Ephah, Epher, Hanok, Abida, and Elda'a. All these were children of Keturah. Abraham gave all he had to Isaac, but the sons of his concubines, Abraham gave gifts, and while he was still living, he sent them away from his son Isaac eastward to the east country. These are the days of the years of Abraham's life, 175 years. Abraham breathed his last and died in a good old age, an old man and full of years, and he was gathered to his people. Isaac and Ishmael, his sons, buried him in the cave of Machpelah, in the field of Ephron, the son of Zohar, the Hittite, east of Mamre, the field that Abraham purchased from the Hittites. There Abraham was buried with Sarah his wife. After the death of Abraham, God blessed Isaac his son, and Isaac settled at Beer Lahai Roy. So there you have it, the death of Abraham. And there's kind of just transitionary and kind of putting the last page on the story of his life. But there are a couple significant things here. It points out like all Abraham's other sons. And I think it does that just for that simple statement that he gave everything he had to Isaac and gave gifts to those sons and sent them all away. And once again, just like it was with Ishmael, it wasn't so much because he hated Ishmael or didn't like him or didn't whatever, but it was because of the fact that he understood that the promise was to Isaac. And so you see here really Abraham as kind of his last dying act to ensure that the line continues through Isaac, because he understood that Isaac was the son of promise. And so even though he had all the other children, you know, it's not like he sent them away because he didn't like them, but he sent them away in faith because he knew that Isaac was going to be the son of promise and that Isaac was going to be the line. And so he sends them all away. He gives everything he has to Isaac and he dies. And then that last little closing note kind of confirms the transfer, if you will, and the blessing transfers to Isaac, right? And God blessed Isaac. And so you see, once again, the death of the man of faith. And you say, you know, is God's plan going to continue? But it continues. The line continues. The seed continues. The plan continues. God is going to finish his promise. He's going to bring it about. And we keep tracing it through, and it's not tied to one man. It's not tied to man, but it's tied to his faithfulness and his word. And so we continue to see that that plan will continue on. And so it's a fitting end to the life of Abraham. And we do just glory and our praise for the fact that God's plan continues on even to us, and that his plan will continue even on through us, and even until he brings in his kingdom. We just see that his plan cannot fail, and it did not die with Abraham. And so ends the life of faith of Abraham. So a lot of good lessons there, yes.
Now, I've heard that the culture was so different back then that it was such that, you know, women couldn't really survive on their own. And that's why there were concubines and stuff. But it seems kind of weird that at the very end of his life, it would mention that Abraham had concubines. It seems to be a little bit of a smudge.
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, that's certainly, when you go back to obviously even Jesus' teaching, he says, in the beginning it was not so, speaking of multiple, I mean, pretty much all the patriarchs had multiple wives, you know, and obviously you have just what he did with his servant, you know, and that resulted in Ishmael, and certainly all throughout the life of Abraham, that's one of the things that we keep pointing out. The author makes no attempt to hide the fact that Abraham messed up. You know, obviously he lied about his wife twice, you know, and it's, you know, we saw how clearly that the author wasn't trying to portray that in a good light, you know, and there's no kind of sugarcoating the story or paint glossing over it and making Abraham look out to be perfect. And that's one of the things that I appreciate about the story of Abraham, is that as much as an amazing man of faith that he was, I mean, ultimately chapter 22 showing the extent of that, where, you know, it started off as he left his homeland in faith, left everything he knew and trusted in the promise of God. And you see his trust all the way through in various aspects until finally he's willing to kill his beloved son of promise, you know, everything for the sake of God. And yet you do see the blemishes. And so it makes him so much more like us, I guess, and so much more human. And just the reminder that, you know, yes, we fail, but God looks at our faith. And are we going to get up and trust in him? Are we going to continue to walk with him? And that's what God looks for, is just that trust and that faith. The willingness to do great things for God. And it's, I mean, obviously that's the lesson that the Israelites needed, is they're about to go into the promised land. Are they going to obey even when the odds seem ridiculous and they're going up against walled cities and walking in circles around them and all the other crazy stuff that God called them to do? Are they going to trust God or are they not? You know, and the same lesson for us. Are we going to trust God even when, you know, whatever kind of, you know, dilemmas or circumstances we're thrown into the midst of? Do we believe that God can bring about a resolution? Do we believe that God can work in powerful ways through us too? And so we see here so clearly that he can and he does. That's good.
I think it's interesting that Isaac and his half-brother Ishmael buried their father.
Mm-hmm.
That, I mean, as two people, they're men, right? So they know history.
Mm-hmm.
And they know who's getting the blessing. Okay, so Ishmael and his mother's already been, shall we say, booted out once. But obviously they've remained, apparently, under his general umbrella.
Well, I think I think it goes back to reinforce, too, that, you know, Abraham loved Ishmael. I'm sure Ishmael loved Abraham, you know. It wasn't for lack of good relationship. It just points out, once again, God's election. And that actually is a good transition, because now look at the next few verses. It starts off with the next toledot, i.e., you know, these are the generations of Ishmael, Abraham's son, whom Hagar the Egyptian, Sarah's servant, bore to Abraham. These are the names of the sons of Ishmael, named in the order of their birth: Nabaioth, the firstborn of Ishmael, and Kedar, Abdil, Mibsam, Mishma, Duma, Masa, Hadad, Tima, Jetur, Naphish, and Kedemah. These are the sons of Ishmael, and these are their names by their villages and by their encampments, 12 princes according to their tribes. These are the years of the life of Ishmael, 137 years. He breathed his last and died and was gathered to his people. They sailed from Havilah to Shur, which is opposite Egypt, in the direction of Assyria. He settled over against his kinsmen. Then you'll notice 19, these are the generations of Isaac. And so, as we said, there's 10 of these are the generations of statements that run throughout Genesis and really give it its whole form. And here, this one in verses 12 to 18 is just this short little section. And it's like, if these are the major divisions, why does he put this like little short, these are the generations of Isaac in here? But I think it really once again serves to show the election of Isaac. You know, it kind of, first it does Ishmael, and then it switches to Isaac. And then we'll notice the same thing with Jacob and Esau. It will give up, these are the generations of Esau, and then it'll say, these are the generations of Jacob. And so just in the way that the whole layout of the book lays out, it kind of does, if you will, the unchosen line first, and then the chosen line, in one sense, to emphasize God's election of Isaac and God's election of Jacob over Esau. And so we continue to see that this seed, this line of blessing, that this ultimately Messiah is going to come through the seed of the woman. He's going to crush the head of the serpent, and this hope that just keeps transferring on, that God is choosing his line. And so we continue to see that just as God chose Abraham, he chose Isaac, he chose Jacob, all part of his sovereign plan to bring about his method for blessing the world. And so we see that as we transition ultimately to the next section, which are these are the generations of Isaac. And so anyway, just to kind of leave us with where we're going, is to continue to see God, the outworking of God's plan. Okay, so we've finished the life of Abraham. Closed a major chapter in the book. And I hope a lot of good lessons for us here about trusting in God, walking with God, and seeing God bless in an amazing way, seeing how Abraham was at the center of God's plan. And to be a part of his plan, you need to be get friends with Abraham, as we see. And so obviously that comes all the way down to Christ, where if you want to be included in God's plan for blessing, it's exclusive. Just like it was exclusive in Israel in Old Testament times, it's exclusive in Christ. And that's God's plan to bless the world. So, a lot of great lessons for us. Any closing thoughts or questions?
Something I like to remember personally is just a lot of this stuff just ends up, I mean, even though it's a long ways away, it does reflect on the fact that, you know, I mean, the servant, you know, going to all those lengths to get a wife for Isaac and making sure she was, you know, a good wife. It ends up going back to Jesus, you know. I mean, that stuff is important. The fact that he was faithful to Abraham and God's plan, it did eventually, you know, lead to Jesus coming.
And all this stuff that we're reading about shows us how much that God loves us as individuals. You know, he wasn't just doing this for the people of Israel. He's doing it for all of us.
That's good. God's plan is to save people. All right, well, let's close in prayer. We could continue to just meditate and talk on these things, fellowship in these things as we just reflect on these stories. But let's close in prayer. Our Father, we thank you so much for your word. Once again, just so many reminders to us of the need to be faithful and to trust in you. The reminder that you can work powerfully, that you send your angel ahead and allow your plan to be worked out perfectly for those who trust in you. We thank you that we can trust in you, that we know that you're faithful, you always keep your promise. And so we thank you so much for that assurance that we have. We thank you that we are partakers of this blessing, that we are blessed through the seed of Abraham as well, and ultimately through Christ. So we pray that you would use us as part of your plan as well. Help us to be faithful, and we pray these things in his name. Amen.